went into this deal with. When she bought the property, she had the property and she owed $100,000. If she forecloses on her equity, she has the property and she's a successful bidder. She has the property and still owes $100,000. She hasn't been hurt at all in terms of what her underlying relationship with the bank is. In fact, she's in the same place. What she wants out of her foreclosure sale, if you will, however, is the difference between what the underlying debt was and what she sold it for, the spread. If she recoups that spread on the foreclosure sale, then she has, in fact, the benefit of her bargain with Tom, because she has the thing for which she sold Tom the property, which is the equity. And I think that's illustrated well in the consolidated capital numbers in this particular case. When EVA sold that property at foreclosure sale, they received their equity in return in full. There is no issue in this case but that they had 100% recovery of their equity. In fact, it is undisputed that they received more than their equity in this case. So you've got a case here of deciding who gets it. And it really is that simple. It can go one of three places. It can be paid upstream to the senior indebtedness. That is not what the petitioner suggests should be done in this case. It is expressly what the deed of trust prohibits in this case, and to do so would violate the trustee's own noticed terms of sale in this case, where he sold it subject to all of the indebtedness. So it can't go there, and nobody suggests that it should. EVA could keep it. Now, that is the result argued by EVA in this case, that they get to keep anything, even though it's in excess of their equity in this particular situation. And I suggest to you that is both inconsistent with the terms of the deed of trust, as the Court of Appeals observed, but more fundamentally, in terms of determining a rule in this case, it is wholly unfair. And the reason is EVA doesn't have to pay that money to anybody under the contracts at issue here. Now, counsel for the petitioner says, no, they don't have personal liability, but they are the owner of the property, and as a practical matter, they're going to have to pay senior indebtedness. But that is not the issue here.
Why should it be, counsel? I mean, they got the property, and if they don't pay it, the first lien holder is going to come get the property.
Indeed they are, Your Honor, but the rule that I think has to be articulated, again, cannot make a distinction between the lien holder as the successful bidder and a third-party purchaser as a successful bidder. And realize the distinction between those two. EVA, as the foreclosing party, really wears two hats. It's a foreclosing party on the one hand, and it is a purchaser on the other hand. As a foreclosing party, it has no liability to pay any money upstream. As a purchaser, you bet it is going to pay that senior indebtedness, and it's also going to pay whatever it bid.
Or lose the property.
Or lose the property, but those are the rules for any purchaser. Now let's make a distinction. Let's assume EVA is the foreclosing party, but James Smith is the purchaser. James Smith pays $4.7 million to EVA in its capacity as the foreclosing party. EVA does not have to pay that money to anyone. Petitioners concede the point. The deed of trust says that. And indeed, those are the terms under which it was noticed.
So if she wants to keep the property, the first lien holder says you've got to pay me, then she's going to be out $7 million.
Absolutely correct. Now, that's her decision. I don't have any problem at all with her deciding that property is worth $7 million. The problem I've got is with EVA getting to keep the entire $4.7 million and leave the property encumbered with an underlying senior indebtedness of $3 million. What that means, in effect, is that you've got $3 million plus the $7.7 million where the real debt. But when all is said and done, the total debt on this property was only 4.7. It suggests to me that if you've got a cash purchaser coming in, a third party, he's paid $3 million over and above the $4.7 million over and above the senior wrapped indebtedness. And the question, again, is who gets it? Now, to answer that question, I think you go to the trustee's deed, or the deed of trust in this particular case. There, the terms of the deed of trust exactly prescribe what the trustee must do. And the Court of Appeals correctly observed that the only power the trustee has to make a distribution is a function of what's said in the deed of trust. And in this case, it says you pay the expenses, which the Court of Appeals took out. You pay the indebtedness secured hereby, the fifth lien indebtedness, the spread. And then you pay the excess to the owner. And that is what we are asking for here, is that the excess be paid to the preceding owner, which is Consolidated Capital. And if it's not done in that fashion, if the rule of law announced by the petitioners is accepted and is applied as the rule for foreclosing under wrap mortgages, then that rule is going to apply to third-party cash purchasers. It's going to apply when the property is appreciating as well as depreciating, and it's going to apply across the board. The only way to inject certainty into the foreclosure process is to maintain the rule articulated by the Court of Appeals that the trustee under the deed of trust must follow his own contractual authority base, i.e. the deed of trust, and must follow the terms under which he announces the sale to be subject. Now, that latter point is an important one. Case law in Texas is rampant on inconsistencies between the trustee's notice terms and then if he tries to do something else. And the case law is consistent that the trustee must sell pursuant to his notice. Now here he said four liens are going to stay in effect and encumbering this property. But petitioners argue that the trustee is authorized to violate that. That instead of four liens remaining...
Counselor, were those terms set out in the actual posted notice or
yes,
some other way?
The posted notice of trustee sale appears at the transcript at page 117. It says it is subject to the four underlying liens and references the prior notes. The trustee's deed itself, the property, the title property conveyance document here, says we are selling this subject to and conveying it subject to the underlying four liens and prior notes. There is no question here but that the trustee has no authority now to take money and after paying some to EVA, pay some to RAIA as the fourth lien because then he would be selling it subject to not four but three and there wouldn't be, in my view, a valid sale and you wouldn't have any sort of standard that a trustee could thereafter tell the parties when they ask how much is the underlying debt in this particular case. The fundamental issue that I mentioned at the beginning is, I think, the place I will end, which is, with all is said and done, make sure that only the wrap indebtedness is paid before the property is free and clear. And if the wrap indebtedness is not going to be paid, and here it has not been, and if there is, on top of that, a bid price that exceeds, when added to the senior debt, the amount of the promissory note, that is, amount of the wrap note, then you've got an excess. And an excess, under the contractual terms of the deed of trust, goes to Consolidated Capital as the prior party in this case.
Could you take us through the Tom and Mary scenario with a third party purchaser?
Your Honor, I can. I wonder, with permission of counsel, if I can flip over a chart and use a marker so I can write on the
sure they'll link it.
That's supposed to be subject to?
Yes, Your Honor, that one.
Without one of the T's, okay.
can, first let me explain simply what I put up there so that the terms or my handwriting is not a problem. Let's assume the wrapped indebtedness as it is in the consolidated capital case is approximately $3 million. Let's assume further that the fifth limb spread, that is the equity of EVA in this case, is approximately $1.7 million, giving a total wrapped note of $4.7 million. Now you have a foreclosure sale of that. The foreclosure sale is noticed as being subject to the wrapped indebtedness of $3 million. And you have a third party who comes in who bids $4.7 million in cash pursuant to the terms on which the sale is noticed, that is subject to the debt. You have $7.7 million that has been generated, $4.7 in cash, $3 of indebtedness that the owner, a new owner, is going to have to pay. Now let's assume the new owner is not the foreclosing party, which is certainly a contemplated situation in foreclosure cases. The $7.7 million is more than the debt, the total debt on that property. If you'll remember the principle I articulated, when this 7.7 comes in, it should never exceed the total 4.7. If it does, there's excess proceeds. And in this particular case, the excess proceeds are $3 million. Who should they go to? They can't go to pay off this debt because that's inconsistent with the terms. If EVA keeps it, they have received $4.7 million when their investment was $1.7, and the deed of trust has been violated because it says when you get more than $4.7 in total, you have to pay it downstream. That's why you've got a windfall here. There's a protection for EVA. If they are the purchasing party, if not a third party, but they are the ones who bought it, then they, if they want to, can pay off this underlying indebtedness, but they get something for it. They get those deeds of trust. They get those liens under the equitable subordination theory, and they then can get the property.
Well, they ultimately have to pay it, or the original landholder is going to take the property. So they're sitting out there potentially liable for all that upstream debt, aren't they?
Your Honor,
or loss of property.
Contractually, they are not. And if they are not the purchaser at sale, they walk home with $4.7 million. They don't pay to anybody.
That's right, but the property is still liable for that.
The property is, but they don't care because they're not the purchaser. But let's say they are the purchaser. If they get their $1.7 and then still have to pay this debt, but they don't have any money coming in for it, they get the benefit of these liens. And if they're the owner, those liens merge with the ownership and they pay off the $3 million and they get the property free and clear. And consider, that's exactly what should happen, because when they sold the property before this sale, they owed $3 million and they own the property. After the sale, after the foreclosure sale, they own the property and they still owe $3 million. Their economic position vis-a-vis this debt hasn't been damaged at all. Thank
you. May it please the court, fellow counsel. For the record, my name is Patrick Pirtle, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Key West Towers Incorporated and Richard O. Ide, a respondent in the application for writ of error filed by Nelson N. Lee and Wife. In this case, we are also appearing as petitioners on a application that was granted, I believe, because the consolidated case was added to this case. Dealing with the issue of amended versus original answers. I will not address my remarks today to that. I believe the more pertinent issue is the issue of the wraparound mortgage. In this case, as Mr. Lebbark stated, there was a sale of an apartment complex in Amarillo, a series of wraparound transactions. Actually, there were seven notes involved. The
precipitating event that led to the foreclosure was that the owner of the property went into bankruptcy, ceased making payments to my client, Key West, who then ceased making its payments to Lee and so on down the chain to Bernie Peters, and a foreclosure resulted. What distinguishes the Key West case from the Consolidated Capital case is that in the Key West case, the parties involved in the litigation on the promissory notes were not parties to the foreclosure. The foreclosing party did never sought a deficiency against Mr. O'Leary. And it's the failure of the foreclosing party to seek this deficiency which creates an inequity in this case. Just for round figures, the balance owing on the O'Leary note was approximately $938,000 on the date of foreclosure. The bid price of $700,000 would, under conventional foreclosure law, leave a deficiency of $238,000. And that is the error of the Court of Appeals that Mr. Lee is complaining about, is that the Lees did not get the benefit of this $238,000. Well, it's interesting to note that in this particular case, that $238,000 will never be recovered because the claim for deficiency is now barred by limitations.
Don't they have a judgment on that? They just didn't try to foreclose the judgment.
They didn't. Your Honor, just to explain that, the Bernie Peters group is from California, and California has a different rule of law on deficiencies. On a purchase money mortgage, they have no right to seek a deficiency unless the parties contract to the contrary. So I think that explains why they may not have sought that deficiency. I believe that the trial court in this case was very perceptive in its ruling, because in its ruling it determined that the amount that the Lee should recover from Key West was their equity in the note. But it went one step further, and it stated that this judgment would not serve as prejudice to any subsequent suit in the event this deficiency were sought. So I think that we have a rule of law that would be a guidance to real estate lawyers, trustees across the state, that when you sell a piece of property at a foreclosure, the law is, whether it's stated in the notice of sale or not, is that the purchaser is going to take that subject to senior liens and indebtednesses. Therefore, when you make a determination of your bid price, you have got to consider that debt that's going to be existing against the property. By leaving open the option to subsequently pursue a deficiency, the court has given the parties the benefit of their bargain. In this case, Nelson Lee received a judgment for the debt differential between the face amount of the Lee note and the included debt of the O'Leary note. O'Leary, in turn, received a judgment against Lee for the face amount of the O'Leary note less the included debt on the O'Leary note. Both parties, both Lee and O'Leary, retained a right to subsequently sue anyone in the chain for a deficiency in the event Bernie Peters, the foreclosing party, actually sought a deficiency. If I might address some remarks to the Tom and Mary hypothetical, I think that it's beneficial. For the court to realize some erroneous assumptions in the position taken by the petitioners. In the petitioner's fact scenario, they assume that Mary is going to pay Texas Savings, but have not addressed the question that when Mary pays Texas Savings, her equity in the loan, the wraparound mortgage, would be thereby increased. So if you followed the rule of law set forth by the Consolidated Capital case and the Amarillo Court of Appeals, the determination of the debt owing would be Tom's $200,000 wraparound mortgage less the included debt. When Mary pays Texas Savings, the included debt is zero.
So Mary does receive the full benefit of her bargain with Tom, a judgment for $200,000. In a voluntary payment situation where Mary goes in and just voluntarily pays off Texas Savings, she also receives the benefit of the bargain because she is subrogated to the Lynn claim of Texas Savings. So that Mary, in both cases, would receive the $100,000 from Tom as well as the $100,000 subrogated claim of Texas Savings. So I believe that in this situation, Mary would be made whole and there would not be any inequity. Mr. Lebarg made a statement to the court that I think bears repeating, and that is that a note should not be reduced or impaired by its mortgage documents. And I agree with that statement entirely. A note should stand on its own and should be interpreted as such. But we're dealing here with a very unusual and new type of mortgage instrument, a wraparound note. And if you read the terms of that note, it's not a conventional note wherein it says that borrower promises to pay to lender a certain sum. It's a note that includes an obligation on the part of the lender to pay subordinate sums, or I'm sorry, senior sums. So I think that the Court of Appeals in both the consolidated case and in the Lee case read the notes and the related deeds of trust and interpreted the intent of the parties to be that the wraparound mortgage note holder has an obligation to pay the underlying indebtednesses, and therefore the true debt or the debt differential should be the amount recovered in the event of a deficiency. Again, I would like to reemphasize to the court that the Lee case is not a case of a foreclosure. It's a simple suit on a promissory note between parties who are not parties to the foreclosure. And to pronounce a rule whereby the bid price would be the amount to be deducted from the wraparound mortgage debt would provide to the Lees a windfall that would be unjust and inequitable. And we believe that this court should affirm the opinion of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Wouldn't the easy way out of all of this is just simply follow Polonius' advice to Laertes? Neither a borrower nor a lender.
I agree, Your Honor. This is an unusual or an emerging form of mortgage financing, and it is a very confusing area. I think the treatises that have dealt with it have been critical of the way that attorneys have drafted their mortgage documents. I think that one thing that could be learned from this is that if the mortgage documents themselves were to be more specific as to how the proceeds would be distributed in the event of a foreclosure, we'd avoid the consolidated capital situation. If the mortgage document had specifically stated that the trustee could pay it upstream, well then the position advocated by the petitioners would be more valid, I believe.
Well, if the foreclosure is going downstream, it's pretty easy. It's just when the foreclosures start coming upstream, it's the problem, right?
I believe so. And that's the position that my clients have found themselves in. There's a foreclosure that's upstream, and they were not a party to that foreclosure. And fortuitously, the note holder has not sought this deficiency, so a windfall would result to everyone down the line if the prior mortgagors were able to recover a full judgment on the face of the note. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Larry Meyer. I represent the amicus curiae in this case. I am here to advocate a rule of general applicability in cases such as the ones before the court for measuring the deficiency in the case of a foreclosure of a wraparound mortgage. I request that this court promulgate such a rule for the benefit of trustees, of bidding parties, of lawyers, of lenders and of the numerous other parties who have to do with foreclosures in the state of Texas. The rule I advocate is consistent with the positions of the respondents herein and also is consistent with both opinions of the two able prior courts of appeals who have ruled in these consolidated cases. The rule I advocate is that in the event of foreclosure of a wraparound note and mortgage, the measure of the deficiency shall be the total amount owed on the wraparound note reduced by or credited by, number one, the total amount of the included debt, and number two, where the wraparound mortgagee holds the foreclosure sale, also the bid price. That's the consolidated case. Now, where
would you repeat your rule one more time?
Well,
your proposal.
All right, I'll start at the beginning, and I'm also not quite finished yet, Your Honor.
Is it in your brief?
It's in the brief, but in light of these arguments, I'd like to repeat it here because it ties in. Number one, take your full amount of the wraparound note. Full amount of the wraparound note that's owed as of the date of the sale. Offset that by the full amount of the underlying debt as of the date of the sale. Here we split between the two cases before the court as to the remainder of my rule here. Where, as in the consolidated capital case, the wraparound mortgagee holds a sale, then the bid price should also be deducted. Why? Because that's part of the benefit of the bargain between the wraparound mortgagor and the wraparound mortgagee, which is what we're talking about. On the other hand, though, where, as in the Lee case, somebody upstream holds the sale and you don't have the wraparound mortgagee holding the sale, then that bid should be disregarded, as the Amarillo Court properly did, because it's not part of the benefit of the bargain between the wraparound mortgagor and the wraparound mortgagee. Now that's what this whole question is. What was the benefit of the bargain between the wraparound mortgagor and the wraparound mortgagee? And how should the courts measure compensatory damages for the wraparound mortgagee who was wronged by the default by the wraparound mortgagor? That's what all of the briefing in this case boils down to. What is the measure of compensatory damages? Now, we're not talking punitive damages. We're not talking windfalls. What amount of damages is necessary to make the wraparound mortgagee who was wronged whole, to put him in the position he would have been in had there been full performance by the defaulting wraparound mortgagor? That's basic compensatory damages. It's first year contract law. I submit my rule would do that and would cover the different situations we have here today. My rule would require that any court interpreting this situation in measuring the compensatory damages would read the document, read the wraparound note, read all of it. Don't pick and choose parts of it. It would require the court interpreting and calling this measure of damages to read the wraparound deed of trust, all of it, not just part of it. The purpose of that exercise would be to see what was the benefit of the bargain agreed to between the wraparound mortgagor and the wraparound mortgagee. And again, that's all this boils down to. What was the benefit of the bargain between those two parties? And in the event of default by one, that is the wraparound mortgagor, what should the other one get in order to make him whole in the sense that he would have been whole had there been full performance by the parties? Now, in the two wraparound mortgage cases before this court, and the one that the amicus curiae is involved in the federal district court in Houston, and in all the other wraparound mortgage cases I'm aware of, the structure of the deal is like this, that the wraparound mortgagor indeed is liable for the full amount of the wraparound note. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, though, the wraparound mortgagee is liable for the full amount of the underlying note. So in the event of full performance, where does this all wash out? Your wraparound mortgagee is better off by the amount of what has been called the spread or the true debt or the equity, that is the difference between those two. Now that's his bargain. In the event of full performance, that's all he ought to ever get. And that's the basis of the rule I'm advocating. Give that wraparound mortgagee the benefit of his bargain, that is the new debt, the spread, the equity, whatever you want to call it, and don't give him a windfall. The facts of the case that my client happens to be involved in the Federal District Court in Houston sharply show the difference between the positions advocated by the parties. They show the inequities of the position advocated by the petitioners much more sharply than either of the fact situations before this court. In that case, you have a wraparound mortgage of $4,500,000, wrapping one underlying debt of $4,350,000. So there's a spread or a real debt or an equity of $150,000. Your wraparound mortgagee holds the sale there, bids $50,000, and herein lies the stark difference in the positions of the parties here. In the suit by the wraparound mortgagee saying, I want to be whole, made whole, I want my compensatory damages, wraparound mortgagor says, I owe you $100,000. That's $4,500,000 minus $4,350,000 minus $50,000. Wraparound mortgagee says, not so. You owe me $4,450,000. That being $4,500,000 less $50,000. So the wraparound mortgagee says he ought to be better off by $4,300,000 in the event of a default than he would be in the event of full performance. I submit that that is an absurd result. It was not within the contemplation of the parties. It is the windfall that the Amarillo Court of Appeals talked about in its opinion. And I respectfully submit that adopting the petitioner's position here would create this windfall. Perhaps not in such a stark form in other cases, but it would create a windfall nonetheless. The Amarillo Court gives a very good example of a windfall involving less dramatic numbers than mine. But
well, let me see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying that you could wind up with a windfall of approximately $4 million. The original mortgagee takes the property back, but your guy still has the $4 million.
Well, that's exactly the windfall. Let's take my $4 million facts here. Okay, a wraparound mortgagee doesn't get paid by a wraparound mortgagor. Wraparound mortgagee hosts. If the petitioner's position here is adopted, then the wraparound mortgage or owes $4,450,000, which is $4,500,000 less $4,450,000. Meanwhile, wraparound mortgagee has the property burdened with the debt, to be sure. Okay, then what can wraparound mortgagee do at that point? First of all, wraparound mortgagee puts that $4,450,000 judgment in his pocket and then can go make the same deal with the next guy. Let's say he makes an identical wraparound transaction with another purchaser. And let's say that one's fully performed. Okay, in that case, underlying debt's taken care of, $150,000 is put in the mortgagee's pocket. But in addition there, too, in the other pocket over here, this wraparound mortgagee has got $4,450,000. Now that's the windfall. And that's the windfall that these petitioners are asking this court to create. Same facts if there were a cash sale after that first foreclosure sale. The included debt's taken care of, the $150,000 equity is put in the pocket of the wraparound mortgagee, but again, he's still sitting there with this $4,450,000 judgment in his pocket. That's a pure windfall. It was not in the contemplation of the parties. Here we get back to the contract law. It stretches credulity that any rational wraparound mortgagor would agree to a deal whereby in the event of default, he was $4,300,000 worse off in the event of default than in the event of full performance. That was not the intent of the parties. The intent of the parties is what the court gleans by reading the entire wraparound note and the entire wraparound deed of trust. That is, on the one hand, wraparound mortgagee collects money, and on the other hand, wraparound mortgagee pays money. So give him the spread, the benefit of the bargain, to the wraparound mortgagee. Amicus Curiae request that this rule be adopted and that the lower court opinions be affirmed. Thank you.
May it please the court. We are not asking for a windfall. And contrary to Mr. Tarpley's response to Justice Wallace's question, the real estate market is of primary importance to the rule of law to be announced in these cases. Defaults frequently, generally, usually, occur when the value of the property is less than the purchaser agreed to pay. That's the problem with the rule of law urged by respondents. In the case of Mr. Meyer's hypothetical, the hotel that was purchased for $4.5 million, where the true debt, Mr. Meyer says, is simply $150,000. The purchaser agreed to pay $4,500,000 to the seller to purchase that hotel. That was the agreement. Now, if the buyer defaults and the purchaser has to go in and foreclose on his security, he may or may not at that point have a hotel that's worth $4,500,000. If that hotel's in Houston, and I think it is, it may not be worth the ground it's sitting on. That's the same problem with Tom and Mary. It's the same problem with Eva and Comcast. It's the same problem with the O'Learys, the Lees, and Key West. The property is worth less than they agreed to pay for it, and they don't want to pay for it. That's understandable. That's fine. But don't tell the seller that he can't recover what he thought he was selling it for simply because it's sold under a wraparound note as opposed to some other type of note.
In other words, you're saying that in that kind of case, the purchaser, the mortgagor, always gets the benefit of the gamble on real estate values, but the seller always takes the downside, if there is a downside.
Exactly, Your Honor. In their case, in the hotel hypothetical, that purchaser will never have to pay what he agreed to pay for that hotel. The only way to require that purchaser to pay what he agreed to pay for the hotel is to look at it as a wraparound note as containing one of three types of obligations to pay the difference upstream. Either there's an express obligation, and that's what the O'Learys had. Their note says, we, Alice and Nelson Lee, agree to pay the O'Learys. They have to pay. That's also the case in Eva's case. Our note, the Raya note, we say, we, English Village Apartments Limited, promise to pay Raya $500,000 plus 18% interest. We can't get out of that. The case that they keep talking about isn't here yet. That case is where there's no express requirement that they pay. There's no requirement that the purchaser at the foreclosure pay because of the, as Your Honor, Justice Ray recognized, we have the obligation, even aside from our personal liability on the Raya note, to pay the $5 million, the $500,000. The case they're talking about is when none of those things are true. And when the foreclosing party can just walk. Take the $100,000, the $4 million, whatever, just walk. That case is not here yet. And when that case gets here, the only way that the intent of the parties can be respected is by implied covenant in the contract. Now that, this court said in Danziger Oil that we're going to imply a covenant, whatever that covenant may be, if either it's clearly necessary to effectuate the intent of the parties, or it's clearly contemplated, and it's so obvious the parties didn't put it in. In a wraparound note situation, it's both clearly necessary to prevent exactly the windfall that respondents keep referring to, and clearly contemplated. Mr. Meyer asked, what happens if there's full performance? Well, if there's full performance, the underlying notes are paid. The wraparound note holder receives not simply his equity, but the interest spread and the tax benefits and all those other things. And the purchaser owns the property free and clear. Similarly, in Eva's case, and I don't know about the O'Leary's, but in Eva's case, under their wraparound note, if Robert Sill chose to prepay the entire note prior to the maturity date, he could. And that would discharge all of the underlying indebtedness on the property. And the way we know that the parties contemplated that a prepayment of the Sill note would result in a prepayment of the prior note is because Sill agreed to pay the prepayment penalties arising under the prior note. Well, if the prior notes weren't going to be prepaid at the same time the wraparound note was going to be prepaid, there aren't any prepayment penalties under the prior notes because they won't be prepaid. The case that makes the point for me is the Lee versus O'Leary case. Because what the Court of Appeals did was give the Lee the differential, the $73,000 or so, that was the difference between their wraparound note and the underlying note. They were very consistent. They gave the O'Leary's the difference between their wraparound note and the underlying note. And what happened is that the O'Leary's are going to recover $157,000 from the lease. But the lease have only recovered $73,000 from Key West. Because they haven't recovered the amount that's due to them from Key West, the amount that Key West agreed to pay for the property. They can't pay the O'Leary without dipping into their own pocket and pulling out $85,000. That's not right. That's not fair. That's not effectuating the intent and the agreement of the parties. It's also interesting to me that everybody keeps talking about how the deed of trust in Eva's case requires Eva to pay Concat the excess proceeds. What the deed of trust says is that the indebtedness secured by this deed of trust is the $4.7 million Sill note. It doesn't say it secures the differential, the difference, the equity, the beneficiary's equity. It says it secures payment of that $4.7 million note, and that $4.7 million note, absent default, would be paid in full. All $4.7 million in the principal and all of the accrued interest. The deed of trust in this case does not give Eva a right to keep excess proceeds.